happy 4th of July. It's quite an honor to be here today on our nation's birthday. Hope you are having a wonderful day, a safe day. And since it's the 4th of July, I think it's only proper that Woods and Water, South Carolina today is a 4th of July show. And you are listening to Woods and Water, South Carolina. You're not going to hear much about Woods and Water today. You're going to hear from Salute to the Shore, and you're going to hear from one of the pilots of one of the F-16s that's flying or that has just flown down the South Carolina coast. So it's a great day. It's a very special day. And I think a special day like today, we need to start off with our national anthem. So, no, I'm not going to sing it to you, but the words are good. And there are words in here that we never hear. We always sing the first verse, and there's three more verses to this thing. So bear with me. Listen to the words and think about the history of our country for a few minutes. Oh, say can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous fight, or the ramparts we watched were so gallantly streaming, and the rocket's red glare, the bombs bursting in air, gave proof through the night that our flag was still there. Oh, say does that star-spangled banner yet wave o'er the land of the free and the home of the brave. And, you know, back in Memorial Day, I read a speech by Ronald Reagan, and he stated in his speech that he did not know of another national anthem that ended with a question. And that question was something that everybody had to answer for themselves in keeping this nation free. On the shore, dimly seen through the mists of the deep, where the foe's haughty host in dread silence reposes, what is that which the breeze, or the towering sleep, as it fitfully blows, half conceals, half discloses? Now it catches the gleam of the morning's first beam, in full glory reflected now shines in the stream. 'Tis the star-spangled banner. Oh, long may it wave o'er the land of the free and the home of the brave. And where is that band who so vauntingly swore that the havoc of war and the battle's confusion, a home and a country, should leave us no more? Their blood was washed out their foul footsteps' pollution. No refuge could save the hireling and slave from the terror of flight or the gloom of the grave. And the star-spangled banner in triumph doth wave o'er the land of the free and the home of the brave. Oh, thus be it ever when free men shall stand between their loved home and the war's desolation. Blessed with victory and peace, may the heaven-rescued land praise the power that hath made and preserved us as a nation. Then conquer we must when our cause it is just. And this be our motto, in God is our trust. And the star-spangled banner in triumph shall wave o'er the land of the free and the home of the brave. We don't often sing those last three verses, and they're somewhat hard to follow sometimes. You can understand this was written September 13th, 1814, by Francis Scott Key as he witnessed the British bombardment of Fort McHenry in Baltimore Harbor. So it doesn't flow as well as the one that we all know, the first verse that we always sing, our national anthem at the beginning of baseball games or NASCAR races. But it's good to go back and look and remember. And going back, the story, this is from Smithsonian.com, the story behind the Star-Spangled Banner, how it flew proudly over Fort McHenry, inspired an anthem and made its way to the Smithsonian. And again, on a rainy September 13, 1814, British warships sent a downpour of shells and rockets onto Fort McHenry in Baltimore Harbor, relentlessly pounding the American fort for 25 hours. The bombardment, known as the Battle of Baltimore, came only weeks after the British had attacked Washington, D.C., burning the Capitol, the Treasury, and the President's House. It was another chapter in the ongoing War of 1812. And you may know that Francis Scott Key at the time, he was the 35-year-old American lawyer, had boarded the British flagship on Chesapeake Bay in hopes of persuading the British to release a friend who had recently been arrested. Key's tactics were successful, but because he and his companion had gained knowledge of the impending attack on Baltimore, the British did not let him go. They allowed the Americans to return to their own vessel, but continued guarding them. Under their scrutiny, Key watched on September 13th as the barrage of Fort McHenry began 8 miles away. In a letter he wrote to his mother, it seemed as though Mother Earth had opened up and was vomiting shot and shell in a sheet of fire and brimstone, Key wrote later. But when darkness arrived, Key saw only red erupting in the night sky. Given the scale of the attack, he was certain the British would win. The hours passed slowly, but in the clearing smoke of the dawn's early light on September 14th, he saw the American flag, not the British Union Jack, flying over the fort, announcing an American victory. Key put his thoughts on paper while still on board the ship, setting his words to a tune of a popular English song. His brother-in-law, commander of a militia of Fort McHenry, read Key's work and had it distributed under the name Defense of Fort McHenry. The Baltimore Patriot newspaper soon printed it, and within weeks, Key's poem, now called The Star-Spangled Banner, appeared in print across the country, immortalizing his words and forever naming the flag it celebrated. So, that's just a little history of the Star-Spangled Banner. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you enjoyed listening to the words of some of the verses we no longer sing. And as you celebrate this 4th of July, remember what that flag stands for. You know, the Star-Spangled Banner's history did not start with Francis Scott Key, but a year earlier with Major George Armistead, the commander of Fort McHenry. Knowing that his fort was a likely British target, Armistead told the commander of Baltimore defenses in July 1813 that he needed a flag, a big one. Well, sir, we, sir, are ready at Fort McHenry to defend Baltimore against invading by the enemy, except that we have no suitable ensign to display over the Star Fort, and it is my desire to have a flag so large that the British will have no difficulty in seeing it from a distance. This year, decided to do a really great show, and part of that show is focused on something that happens every 4th of July along the South Carolina coast. It's called Salute from the Shore. And with Salute from the Shore, we're talking to John Michael Otis, Columbia, South Carolina. John, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Roger. Hope you are.
I am doing wonderful. This is the day you guys live for, right?
It is one of our favorite days of the year. It is definitely Christmas, New Year's, and Easter all rolled into one for us.
Just before we get into what it all is and how long does it take y'all? I mean, when do y'all start working on Salute from the Shore 7?
Really, it doesn't start. The planning never stops. We start as soon as the previous year is over with. We're just a small group of concerned patriotic citizens from South Carolina. We came together about 6 years ago and decided we wanted to do something to make a difference in our state and to show appreciation for our military's contribution. So we really plan around the year, around the course of the entire year. It takes a lot to coordinate with various Air Force bases and the FAA and the various constituents up and down the coast who really work hard and sacrifice a lot to make this happen for the benefit of everybody on the beaches every year.
And the only pay you get is that feeling when it's over that, hey, it was a good year.
That's all we need.
That's all you need. Okay, Salute from the Shore. What is this website called, salutefromtheshore.org?
Well, so if you go to salutefromtheshore.org, best way to experience it and to understand what it is to view the videos from actually this year and from the previous years. And what we do is we organize and promote a military flyover of the entire length of South Carolina's coast. And we videotape that and we take user-generated content and we formulate that into a tribute video. We have an official version that we do every year, and you can view those online. And we really encourage people to go to the beach and to commemorate the 4th of July and to show their appreciation for our military in their own way, and then to capture that on video or by photos and submit it online at our Facebook account, on Twitter, or on their own pages or in their own way. It can be a very personal experience for people. But we try to provide a venue for people to do that, and we feel it's South Carolina's most special tribute to the armed forces on our Independence Day.
I love what you did this year with the video. Instead of, as you and I talked the other day and you explained, instead of waiting for an after video that you try to compile that day or the next day, you kind of did a movie preview complete with green screen audience and everything this year.
Yeah, we thought we would try to pump it up a little bit, get people excited about the 4th. Everybody starts getting excited about the 4th of July and going down to the beach and going on vacation, starting probably in the winter when it's so cold and dusty outside. But, you know, we found over the course of a few years of doing this that, you know, the riding that wave of anticipation is so much fun for so many people. And then, you know, as soon as the fourth is over, folks tend to kind of put it to bed and start focusing on the work week and things like that. And we just wanted to take advantage of the anticipation side of it and to infuse it with a little bit of adrenaline. And because this year we're fortunate enough to have Shaw Air Force Base, again, supporting us with a flight of F-16, you know, what better way to do that than with a promotional video that's kind of reflective of a, you know, a Top Gun type theme, you know, movie blockbuster of the summer type of a feeling, because that's really what it feels like to a lot of people that are out there.
Now, did you know that Shaw Air Force Base has their own video?
Which one is that?
They have a video that they have that I saw the other day of pilots getting ready to fly salute from the shore.
Yep. We did that in cooperation with them for our video a couple years ago.
Okay.
And that's a little bit of footage that they've got on file, and it helps us out because we've been doing this for 5 years now, and we've got a pretty good library that we can pull from to kind of spice these things up. And every year we hire our own videographers to go capture new footage and new interviews, both with veterans and with active service people, as well as people just on the beach, and to ask them what the 4th of July means to them, and you know, get their impressions of what Salute from the Shore is like to be on the beach. Because it's really, there's nothing that can compare with actually being there and feeling that wave of emotion come over you when the jets and the vintage planes both come down the beach. It's just not something that any video can really capture. That's why we try to encourage people to experience it firsthand.
Well, how do ordinary average Americans come up with an idea like this?
Well, it starts off very simply. A group of families that go to the beach every year for the 4th and have done this for a long time. And as we're sitting out there on the beach, it's actually the Folsom and the Smith families in particular who go to Litchfield, South Carolina. And maybe 10 years ago, the seed of this was planted when they said, you know, it's really not fair that everybody's over there fighting a war in Iraq. And, you know, we're over here, you know, celebrating on the beach, and nobody's really thinking about what this day means. And so it really snowballed from there into, well, how do we make this happen? How do we get jets to fly the beach? And, you know, we added a few more people to the initiative. And, you know, after a few years of kind of kicking around, we figured out a way to make it happen. And in 2010, we were able to secure a huge C-17 from Charleston Air Force Base. And it flew the entire length of the coast, and we only had about 2 weeks to plan the entire thing, because that's how long it took the Department of Defense to give us permission to do this. I mean, we're in a category that they've never seen before, so we're kind of an entirely different entity.
Right.
But it was, the response was just so huge, and the outpouring of support, and the number of people that told us, you know, both publicly on in venues like Facebook and things like that, but also personally, how much it meant to them. It really inspired us to continue to grow it and to make it bigger and to make this, you know, a sustainable event that people can experience every year, and to really be something that South Carolina can be proud of.
Salute from the Shore. Obviously it's on the beach. So where do you go to see this in South Carolina?
Well, we're visible from every strip of sand that faces the ocean. So it starts in, it starts over Cherry Grove, right over the border, north of Myrtle Beach. And, at 1:00 p.m., the jets will start their run. This year we're fortunate again, after a couple of years of, sequestration budget cuts that, cut into all events like this. But this year we're fortunate enough that, the F-16s from Shaw will start their run at 1:00.
Okay.
And they will go south all the way to Dufusky Island, south of Hilton Head. And typically their run takes about 45 minutes. And that's even flying as slow as they can. Yes, sir. And we try to ask them and beg them, actually, to fly as low and slow and as close to the coast as they can every year.
Uh-huh.
Unfortunately, there are some FAA regulations and, you know, other things that are in the air on the 4th that, you know, they get as close as they can, but obviously safety is everyone's first priority.
Right.
But But in addition to the F-16s, right behind them at Cherry Grove, we have a group of vintage military aircraft. And these are flown by all volunteers. For the most part, they own their own planes. And a wonderful gentleman named Barry Avent from Bennettsville, South Carolina, coordinates that effort for us. This year, we plan to have at least 7 planes flying north from the North Carolina state line to roughly Charleston. And from that point, a few of those planes will continue south, and they'll be joined by another group that will start at Charleston and fly the rest of the way with them. And we did it a little bit differently this year, mainly because some of these planes are very small and don't have air conditioning or facilities.
Right.
It's important that that everybody be able to actually enjoy it rather than be forced to fly 180 miles in a plane that's not really meant to do that.
Now, there's something really cool that goes on with these planes that follow the jets from Shaw, and that is some of these planes will have veterans in them.
Absolutely. And that's an exciting part of it for a lot of people. Every year we try to find out how many of these planes can handle additional passengers, and we organize and find and locate around the state veterans from all the wars going back to World War II that are fortunate enough to be able to fly in the planes and see the people down on the beach saluting back up to them with huge American flags and various and very actually creative ways to show their support from the beach. And after having spoken with a few of those folks personally, and I've known a few of them personally who have participated in that way, it's really an emotional time for them, because there's we estimate roughly 1 million people on the beach between Cherry Grove and Hilton Head, and for them to see that measure of support is really profound for a lot of them.
And those veterans they're actually featured in this trailer for 2015.
They are. Some of them are from previous years. We try to build on what we do every year. The media will actually have access to them on this Friday as we do a sort of a preliminary run. And then we hope that we'll get as much TV coverage and things like that so that we can share their stories in the days to come. And then obviously we try to record and document as much as we can for our production of our video.
And you were telling me, I believe it was Fox News is going to have a crew here?
Yeah, Fox News is actually, they're bringing their entire morning show to Patriots Point in Charleston. And they're going to do a live broadcast from Patriots Point this Saturday. So that's kind of a neat event for South Carolina and for Charleston to have that national broadcast. And, we've actually... our president, current president Andy Folsom, was on their broadcast a year or two ago in support of this initiative. And it's really neat that they're going to be down here and they're going to feature us as part of their coverage. One of our vintage planes is actually going to conclude their broadcast by flying in the background as they stop their footage at 9:30 in the morning.
Very nice.
And their correspondent, I believe Heather Denich, is going to take a ride on Friday and with one of our vintage air pilots and sort of get some video of the beach as well. So that's a neat aspect to this year that we don't always get. We love national news. We like South
yes.
Carolina to be in the news for positive reasons.
Yes.
And that's one of the reasons we do things like this.
We've kind of covered most of it. How do people participate?
The best way you can participate is to actually go to the beach. Go to the beach, get creative, take your flags, wear your red, white, and blue, and salute the troops in your own way. And if you feel the urge, we encourage people to take pictures and take videos and, memorialize people that you may know or may be related to with testimonials either on our website. We have a portion of our website set up where you can submit a testimonial to a specific person, or just to submit photos and images on our Facebook page or Instagram or Twitter or whatever you happen to be on. Use hashtag Salute from the Shore. And obviously you can visit www.salutefromtheshore.org to find out more information.
1 million people along the beach of South Carolina over the 4th of July. That's
We've never had somebody dispute that number yet.
you and I were talking earlier, and some people out there probably don't know how much South Carolina contributes to our military effort here in the United States, because we have a lot of places, and you were naming off a few. So, you know, we've got, of course, the fighter jets from Shaw Air Force will be there, but list a couple of the other ones that you know of that are bases that are here just here in South Carolina.
Sure. I mean, you know, dating back, you know, to the origins of the 13 original colonies, South Carolina has always made a tremendous contribution to our nation's defense. We have Fort Jackson here in Columbia where I live. We have Shaw Air Force Base, Charleston Air Force Base, Beaufort Naval Air Station, Paris Island. So we really have a strong legacy and a strong history with the military here in South Carolina. And, you know, we read, our leadership read not long ago that there was a poll that was taken online, and South Carolina actually ranks number one in terms of the most patriotic state in America. And obviously that's something that we all feel intuitively, but it's something that we have to continue to share and to work on, and especially to teach the next generation. Because some of us have children that are in their impressionable years, and
right.
It's important that they understand that the 4th of July is more about going to the beach and going out on a boat and swimming and, you know, eating good food and barbecue and all that. You know, it's about really thinking about how our nation was founded and the principles that keep us going every day.
Yeah, earlier this week we were watching a fireworks display, and I was thinking back to when Francis Scott Key wrote the national anthem and what he must have been watching, because the fireworks are supposedly, you know, similar somehow to correlate to what he was watching, the bombardment of Fort McHenry. And, I was just thinking back that far, what he must have felt on that ship and what I felt just watching those few little fireworks going on. I can't imagine what it would be like to be on the beach and feel that same sensation come over.
It's a very powerful moment. And like you say, it's something that can't really be described. It can only be felt. And that's why we can encourage as many people as possible to participate and to go out on the beach. Some of the personal stories that we've heard have really been the most impactful. You know, a son who goes out and waves the flag that was presented to him on the event of his father's, his father's burial. He died in service, things like that. And you don't always hear about those online. We don't always have a chance to capture those through video or through a Facebook post or something like that. But, when people call you personally and they tell you how much it meant to them, you know, it really inspires us to keep doing this and to keep growing it and to keep sharing that message that South Carolina loves our military and that we appreciate both the veterans and especially the active service people who give up so much to do that for us every year.
And Woods and Water South Carolina is totally behind you on that message.
Well, we certainly appreciate it, Roger.
You're welcome. Okay, you're a 501c3 corporation, which means people can donate to the cause, correct?
That's correct. We've been fortunate to have some small measure of corporate sponsors that have helped us out over the years, but every dollar we get helps us to keep the planes in the air and to keep growing this bigger and better every year. We do contribute a great deal of money to defray the fuel expense,
right?
Especially of the vintage planes.
Yes.
Depending on that budget really dictates how many planes we can get in the air, the kinds of things that we can do to continue to work on this and to make it a bigger and better event. So, you know, if you're so inclined, we encourage you to go to our website, the donate button there, just log on, use PayPal. And, obviously everything's tax deductible. And, we don't draw salaries. We do this purely to make the Fourth a better experience for everybody on South Carolina's beach.
Well, John, I appreciate you coming on with me today. The web address is salutefromtheshore.org. Go there, look at the videos, get excited. If you had to tell people one last thing, I guess it'd be to get to the beach, right?
Get to the beach, wave your red, white, and blue, and just enjoy yourself, and just remember that there's a lot of people that in the past and in the present who have sacrificed a lot so that we can celebrate this special holiday.
Absolutely correct. You have a wonderful 4th of July.
You too. Thank you, Roger.
Yes, sir. welcome back to 4th of July on Woods and Water, South Carolina. You know, I've had some, I guess, famous guests on the show, but I have never had a guest that I am more honored to talk to and introduce to you than one of the captains from the 79th Fighter Squadron called the Tigers from Shaw Air Force Base here in South Carolina. How are you today?
I'm doing great. How are you doing, Roger?
I am doing wonderful. And I said before, I am honored. I want to thank you first off for your service to our country. And above that, thank you for coming on Woods and Water.
No, I really appreciate it.
Very, very nice. I guess one of the burning questions on everyone's mind is, were you always interested in flying?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the long story short, yeah. I grew up in North Carolina. I'd always been interested in flying, but I didn't think, honestly, I'd qualify because I wore glasses when I was younger.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, so I'd like to let everybody know that I don't have 20/20 vision. You can totally be a fighter pilot in the Air Force. There are waivers that can happen.
Okay. When you have that problem, do you just shoot what's in the middle, not the ones on the outside?
Yeah, they got some pretty neat techniques nowadays with contacts and laser surgery that kind of help you out once you get in the Air Force.
Very good.
Yeah, exactly.
Very good. So you grew up here in North Carolina. You love to fly. I mean, what's one of your favorite airplanes to fly?
Yeah, so joining the Air Force, I hadn't flown any previously.
Really?
So the Air Force has taught me everything I know as far as flying aircraft.
Wow.
I've flown GA-20s, T-6s, T-38s. And I finally settled in on the Viper, which is the S-16, and obviously
right.
My personal favorite.
That's your favorite?
Hell yeah. Got about 800 hours in it. It's been pretty awesome. For
wow. Hours. And for those of you sitting in a desk behind your chair, that's almost 5 months of going to work every day.
Yeah, that's the J-O-B, day in and day out, Monday through Friday, and sometimes the weekends. But
yeah.
I love it every second.
You know, I have sat in the cockpit of an F-16 back in
nice.
Like the mid-80s when Shaw Fest was going on, and you could climb up and sit in one, and I was just a teenager then. Sitting in that cockpit, you could see a little bit of the nose out in front of you. Of course, the heads-up display, and I thought to myself, this has got to be one of the coolest seats to sit in for a job.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely flying has been an absolute dream. They talk about you strap into a Viper where other aircraft kind of sit into them and stuff
right.
like that. It's small, it's lightweight. You knock them out 1.5 hours a day. In the Block 50, and it's the best that money can't buy. That's just been a unique experience, and I'd like to thank everybody out there for helping me achieve my dream.
Well, it's we like to thank you for defending our country and representing South Carolina. Tell us what you can about the F-16.
Yeah, so all the pilots refer to it as the Viper. It's got a thrust to weight about 1-to-1, meaning vertical takeoff should be possible if required for some reason.
Okay.
It's smaller, so it's just got just enough gas to get to the target and back. And while we're doing that, we can hit altitudes of about 50,000 feet, 1,400 miles an hour, if required. Last thing is, additionally, it pulls 9 Gs, which can be a very intense and brutal experience.
I imagine.
That puts my weight right around 1,700 pounds, and my nugget at 90 pounds, so my head. And all this
wow.
means that it just hurts a lot. But anyway, it's between you and him. You'd like to be able to pull 9 Gs.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I'm sure. The difference between surviving and not surviving.
Yeah, exactly.
When you say your body multiplies, can you explain to us just a bit how that multiplier happens?
Yeah, I don't want to get too ridiculous with the science,
sure.
but long story short, while we're sitting here talking on the phone, it's 1G is what you feel right now. So I weigh 185 pounds or so.
Okay.
And then as you start to turn or start to get into a bank of a turn, those Gs start to multiply. And then at a given airspeed, the more G you can pull, the tighter you can turn.
Okay.
And hopefully you can turn inside the other guy and potentially defend yourself.
And your body just, those G-forces just multiply the effective weight of your body.
It does, yeah. So, like, if you ever end up being a fighter pilot after 9 Gs, you'll be able to look at his body, and there's going to be little measles all over his body.
Okay.
It's actually burst capillaries from all the blood pressure that's gone to the bottom of their, like, bottom of their arm, the sides of their chest. It's pretty nasty. My mom thought once and she freaked out. But it's kind of fun while you're doing it, and then afterwards you're sore.
Okay. So it's fun once, and then you figure it out.
Yeah, well, then you've got to do it again the next day.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, since we're going to get to Salute to the Shore just quickly, but since none of us listen will ever know what it's like flying an F-16, punching an afterburner, playing around in the clouds, is it just the best adrenaline rush you've ever had?
Yeah, so, I mean, like I said, we do 1.5 hours at a time, but as soon as you close that canopy and you go JFS start 2, so the motor gets started there.
Okay.
I mean, the jet rumbles alive, shakes a little bit, lets you know it's alive.
And okay.
Then, You get down, taxi down to end a runway. They arm you up, so they pull the pins, and you know it's time to go. So air-to-air configured loads. She's light, rolls pretty quick, and with a big motor, can sustain pretty well in dogfighting.
Right.
And you kind of mentioned you can barely see the nose when you're sitting there.
Right.
The Viz in the F-16 is the best that I've ever seen.
Okay.
So my ability to sit in my cockpit and look out and see the enemy is better than, I think, anything out there today. So combine that ability to dogfight with sustaining energy and that visibility, this thing will hold its own against anything out there.
I love to see them. I love to hear them. I was down for the East Coast Viper demo at Media Day, and just was in heaven. In heaven. Well, tell us, how is it that Shaw Air Force Base is participating in Salute from the Shore?
Yeah, so, I mean, honestly, it came down from our leadership, and I think everybody loves 4th of July in America, so that's pretty awesome. So having the ability to take the Vipers down the coast and get a little FaceTime with the public hopefully bolsters our presence to the public and let them know that, hey, we're here and that we're standing ready for anything that, you know, essentially the government or the public calls on us ready to do. So, and then for me, it's cool because we get to express thanks to the support that we get from the public, like yourself, you mentioned. I appreciate all that support. Plus, I get to tour the beaches in South Carolina.
There you go.
Red wine.
There you go.
That's pretty sweet.
Will this be your first flight down the coast?
It actually will be. There is a couple of training opportunities out there, and I have done none of them. So this will be my first flight to South Carolina down the coast. That's going to be awesome. Can't think of a better day to do it than July 4th.
Well, I was just fixing to say that when I interviewed the gentleman from Salute the Shore, he said there'd probably be a million people on the beaches.
Jeez.
And if a quarter of those have American flags, boy, I tell you, you will have no problem picking them out, will you?
No, that's gonna be amazing. It'd be sweet.
Now, I'm sure going down the coast, you're not gonna be wide open. How fast will you be going when you're going down the coast?
Yeah, we're gonna be holding back a little bit. The folks out there can expect I'll be doing what we call 350 indicated, which is about 400 miles an hour. And I'll be anywhere from about 500 feet above ground to about 1,000, depending on the traffic that's out there.
Okay. Now, that is just incredible. And that's got to be a view that not only flying down the beach, but all those flags is going to be great for you guys.
Oh, it'll be serene.
Well, I appreciate you coming on. Is there anything you'd like to say in closing?
Yeah, I just want to say, ladies and gentlemen, it's been a pleasure serving this Air Force for y'all. I'd like you to come out to the beaches of South Carolina. And as long as Mother Nature cooperates, I'll be out there. Thanks a lot.
Well, we appreciate you. We appreciate the Air Force, all the armed services, and have a very, very, very good 4th of July.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Yes, sir.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Well, what a job. What a job. And I kid you not, when you are sitting in the cockpit to an F-16, there's nothing that gets in your way. The body of the jet slopes away from you on either side. The nose is just barely visible. And, wow, if you've ever sat in one, you know what I mean. If you haven't, chance you might never get now. Things have really changed, but we appreciate the U.S. military not only for supporting Salute to the Shore, which is a private 501c3 organization. We appreciate them for providing the captain to come on Woods and Water, South Carolina, and talk and tell us a little bit about what it's like to be a fighter pilot. And I was down at the media event there for the East Coast Viper. And you can go to the Woods and Water South Carolina Facebook page and the website. And I have put up some pictures from that day. And it was incredible. I'm a runway junkie from way back. So it was a day in heaven for me, or a couple hours in heaven with the jets taking off, the afterburners, and like I said, the Thunderbirds are kind of the grandiose smoke trailing display for the U.S. Air Force. The East Coast Viper demo team is, here's what the F-16 can do in a fight. And they do it very well. Very, very well. So that was kind of cool. That's the 4th of July show here. I'm going to continue on with a little bit. We were talking about Francis Scott Key and how the flag came. And we had talked a little bit about the commander of the garrison there at Fort McHenry asking for a flag. And he said, it's my desire to have a flag so large that the British will have no difficulty in seeing it from a distance. So he hired a 29-year-old widow and professional flag maker, Mary Young Pickersgill of Baltimore, Maryland, to make a garrison flag, get this, measuring 30 by 42 feet with 15 stars and 15 stripes. Of course, each star and stripe representing a state. A large flag, but not one unusual for the time. Over the next 6 weeks, Mary, her daughter, three of Mary's nieces, a 13-year-old indentured servant, and possibly Mary's mother, Rebecca Young, worked 10-hour days sewing the flag using 300 yards of English wool bunting. They made the stars, each measuring 2 feet in diameter, from cotton, a luxury item at the time. Initially, they worked from Mary's home, now a private museum known as the Flag House, but as their work progressed, they needed more room and had to move to Claggett's Brewery across the street. On August 19, 1813, the flag was delivered to Fort McHenry. Get this, for making the Star-Spangled Banner, Mary was paid $405.90. She received another $168.54 for sewing a smaller, 17 by 25 feet, storm flag, likely using the same design. It was this storm flag, not the garrison flag known, now known as the Star-Spangled Banner, which actually flew during the battle. The garrison flag, according to eyewitness accounts, wasn't raised until the morning. So, there's your little bit of a history lesson. And hang on, we're going to take a break. Come back on the other side with more Woods and Water, South Carolina. And welcome back to Woods and Water, South Carolina. Going to take a few more minutes to go over just the end of the Smithsonian article about the Star-Spangled Banner. After the Battle of Baltimore, Armistead remained in command of Fort McHenry for the rest of his life. Historians are not sure how the Armistead family came into possession of the flag, but upon his death in 1818, his wife Louisa inherited it. It is she who is thought to have sewed the red upside-down V on the flag, beginning the stitches for the letter A. She is also thought to have begun the tradition of giving pieces of the flag as a way to honor her husband's memory, as well as the memories of the soldiers who defended the fort under his command. When Louisa died in 1861, she passed the flag down to her daughter, Georgiana Armistead Appleton, over the legal objections of their son. Georgiana was the only child born at the fort, and she was named for her father, says Thomason Krause. Louisa wanted Georgiana to have it. The missing pieces. In 1873, Georgiana loaned the flag to George Preble, a flag historian who until that time had thought the flag was lost. That same year, Preble had the first known photograph of it taken at the Boston Navy Yard and exhibited it at the New England Historical Genealogical Society, where he stored it until 1876. While the Star-Spangled Banner was in Preble's care, Georgiana allowed him to give away pieces of the flag as he saw fit. Georgiana herself had given away cuttings of the flag to other Armistead descendants, as well as family friends. She once noted, "Had we given all that we had been importuned for, little would be left to show." This family tradition continued through 1880, with the grandson giving away the last documented piece. Several of these cuttings from the Star-Spangled Banner have been located over the years, including about a dozen that are owned by the American History Museum. We're aware of at least a dozen more that exist in other museums and private collections. But a missing 15th star has never been found. There's a legend that the star was buried with one of the soldiers from Fort McHenry. Another says that it was given to Abraham Lincoln. But no real evidence has surfaced to support these stories, and the true fate of the star remains one of the Smithsonian's greatest unsolved mysteries. 100 years of the Smithsonian. After Georgiana's death, the flag passed to Eben Appleton, Armistead's grandson, who loaned it to the city of Baltimore for the 1880 sesquicentennial celebration. It then remained in a safe deposit vault in New York City until Appleton loaned it to the Smithsonian in 1907. 5 years later, he made the gift permanent, saying he wanted it to belong to the institution in the country where it could be conveniently seen by the public and where it would be well cared for. When the flag arrived at the Smithsonian, it was smaller, 30 by 34 feet, damaged from years of use at the fort and from pieces being removed as souvenirs. Recognizing its need for repair, the Smithsonian hired Amelia Fowler, an embroidery teacher and well-known flag preserver, in 1914 to replace the canvas backing that had been added in 1873. Having worked on historic flags for the United States Naval Academy, Fowler had patented a method of supporting fragile flags with a linen backing that required a honeycomb pattern of stitches. With the help of 10 needlewomen, Fowler spent 8 weeks on the flag, receiving $1,243 for the materials and work. For the next 50 years, with the exception of a brief move during World War II, the Star Spangled Banner was displayed in what is now the Arts and Industries Building. Because of the flag's size and the dimensions of the glass case it was displayed in, the public never saw the entire flag while it was housed in this location. That changed after architects designed the new National Museum of History and Technology, now the National Museum of American History, with space to allow the flag to hang. The Star Spangled Banner remained in Flag Hall from 1964 until 1999, when it was moved to the Conservation Lab. With the recent completion of the project, the Star Spangled Banner will remain an icon of American history that can still be seen by the public, says Glass. The survival of this flag for nearly 200 years is a visible testimony to the strength and perseverance of this nation, and we hope that it will inspire many more generations to come. Again, that was an article from the Smithsonian Mag. You can go there, www.smithsonianmag.com, history, the story behind the Star Spangled Banner, and read it for yourself. I hope you've enjoyed this show. It's been fun to work on. It's been some work dealing with the Department of Defense and the U.S. Air Force, although, and you have to respect their wishes and their reasoning, although you may not know it or the reasons behind it, but we do appreciate them being part of this. And we're going to get back to just a little bit of woods and water. I guess you could call it a little bit of what we normally do here. In looking at our country and how we hunt and fish and the availability to go to Walmart, buy a $10 fishing license, go fishing, or take a hunter safety course, 8 hours, and get a hunting license if you're big game hunting. You know, it's so easy. There's public land out there. And I don't know how many of you think about where we came from and how the hunting there has changed. You know, in the United States, when it was settled, it was decided that the game would be owned by the people, not the landowner. So, you know, that game that's on my piece of land or my hunt club, it's really only mine until it crosses the boundary, and then it's, you know, fair game for somebody else. And the fishing, you know, the waterways are open. But I have friends from Germany, I have friends from Ireland and England, and it's so different there. And I think we ought to take a minute just to think about how lucky we are here in the United States to have the access and the ability and the ability to own guns. Anywhere in Europe right now, it is not next to impossible to get one. So I went and did a little searching the other night, and this is from Germany, and you know, the rich heritage of hunting in Germany. And they're interviewing a hunter, Gunther Eggersdorf. He says, "The nature. I love the nature. That is all. In a sense, that says a lot, because getting a hunting license in Germany is both difficult and expensive. Most hunting in Germany happens on private agricultural lands. Hunters pay thousands of euros to lease a hunting area for 9 years. Now we pay to have hunt clubs and all here." It says his hunting is 400 hectares of territory. In Germany, if you believe this, the guy that leases the land is responsible for any damage that the game he's hunting causes. In other words, if pigs invade a farmer's cornfield, the hunter is responsible for reimbursing the farmer. So that's hunting in Germany. Then you go right next door to France, and I downloaded this from a French hunting organization. Hunting is tightly controlled in France. No one may hunt without a valid hunting license. The license permits a hunter to hunt in a given territory for a given period. And it's loaded with places you click to go to more pages of regulations and all. Kind of goes through it, but it says hunting licenses in France. In order to have the right to hunt in France, it is necessary to have a hunting permit. Hunters have to pass a theory and practical exam before being given a license. Both of these exams are organized by the National Hunting and Wildlife Agency. They're held all year round. To prepare for the exam, candidates have to undergo a obligatory training course. Candidates cannot take the practical exam until they have passed the theory exam and must be at least 15 years old on the day of the theory exam. If the candidate fails one of the exams, then they must begin the process again and fill in a new application form. And then it goes through the process for just the application process to get a license. Archery. In order to hunt with a bow and arrow, candidates must have a valid hunting license and must undergo specific training carried out with the Hunting Federation of their home department. Don't know what that means. Once the candidate has passed both the exams, applications for the hunting license may be made at the home prefecture. That's, you know, kind of the police department where you're at. The application must include the following: hunting license application form, two passport size photographs, hunting exam certificate, proof of identity, and a fee. And the fee is high. And then they talk about validation of the hunting license, permits you need to get to be able to hunt, insurance. Hunters have to have insurance and must carry proof of their insurance when hunting. To have their hunting permit validated, they must show proof of insurance. Guarantee fund. In the event of a hunting accident where the offender is not known or uninsured, the injured person may make a claim at the, and they give the name I can't pronounce, which means you have like almost an uninsured hunter's policy, like uninsured motorists. Just making it tough to do. In England, United Kingdom, they're a little more lenient. You don't need a license to hunt game birds, pheasants, and grouse. When you can hunt is very specific. Deer, you don't need a license to hunt deer in open season. Hunting out of season or night is illegal, of course. That's the only mention I had to that. But in, and you can hunt some small games on certain days of the year. But there again, you have to have a wildlife license. Hunting equipment you can use. Hunting with guns, you'll need a firearms or shotgun certificate to hunt with shotguns, rifles, or other firearms. You don't need a firearm certificate for air rifles less than 12 feet-pounds in power, air pistols under 6 pounds. Shooting deer. When shooting deer, there are rules. According to the firearms you can use, the type of ammunition you can use, hunting with dogs, you can't use dogs to hunt foxes, hares, or deer. You know, pretty much our heritage fox hunting came from England. Can't do that there anymore. You can use dogs for stalking and flushing out, but only to control pests such as hares and rabbits, retrieving hares that have been shot, and, you know, trail hunting. Other hunting methods you can't ever use, bows or crossbows or explosives. And there are more detailed restrictions on the use of traps, snares, nets, automatic or semi-automatic weapons. So, and then as far as fishing goes, I have a very good friend from Ireland, and of course in Ireland, you have to own the water or get permission from somebody who owns the water to go fishing. So we have it so good here in the United States, and it's something else to think about here on this 4th of July. I wanted to bring in one more story here. It's from the Take Me Fishing blog. 10 surprising ways you can help with fishing conservation. And very quickly, they just go 1 through 10. It's, where's number 1? I guess it's number 1. Okay, number 1. Know the current fishing regulations for your state. When you have knowledge of the fishing regulations, you won't mistakenly keep fish that are oversized or undersized, and you'll know the correct seasons and bag limits for each species. Know how to identify different fish species and have a measuring device with you so you can properly measure your catch. Proper species identification is important when it comes to following the fishing regulations for the seasons mentioned in number 1 above. Number 3, use tackle that is heavy enough to quickly land and release the fish without causing an undue stress. And that's one of the things we struggle with catch and release fishing, is, yeah, we like to go out with fly rods or light line and all, but remember that fish, especially in the summertime, has got to be able to recover from the buildup of lactic acid. I believe it's what builds up in a fish. And that's when you bring a fish in, you need to make sure you revive it by holding its tail, you know, giving it time to revive. You'll notice the fins start fluttering on the sides of the fish, and you'll feel it. You'll feel that tail starting to wag. So use circle hooks when fighting fish. Catch and release fish without removing the water from the water whenever possible. Avoid putting fingers or other objects in the gills of the fish. Handle fish with wet, bare hands. Bring all the trash, fishing line, and tackle back with you after a fishing trip. Take part in volunteer conservation efforts and share these conservation tips with other anglers. So, I want to thank you for being here on the 4th of July. Hope you're having a good one and a safe one. We'll give Chuck a break this week. He's on vacation too. So until next week, make time to get out there. Take the back roads when you can. Hope Salute from the Shore was great. And don't forget your camera. I'll see you next week. Maybe just like a friend of mine.
time.